The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Well, finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here to fill us in on some recent stories from our daily news site. Well, Dave, first up, another bit of evidence on what killed the dinosaurs. Are people really still arguing about that?
I was surprised too, Stuart. I really thought the case was kind of closed. The going hypothesis, as you are well aware, I'm sure, Stuart, is that an asteroid killed the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago, slamming into Earth, causing all this devastation, which caused all of these giant beasts, mostly giant beasts, to disappear. And there's a lot of evidence for that. First of all, this event, which is also sometimes called the KT extinction, is called that because there is basically a layer of Earth called the KT boundary, which dates back to about 65 million years ago. And scientists have found a lot of iridium there. And iridium is not very common on Earth, but it is very common in asteroids. So that's one piece of evidence. And dinosaurs went extinct about 65 million years ago. So the timing adds up. And also, dinosaur fossils disappear around this time. So it all seems to point to this idea that dinosaurs were killed off by the asteroid. But there are some skeptics out there. And what the skeptics say is that dinosaurs actually started going extinct before this asteroid hit. And this was a very gradual extinction. It wasn't a sudden extinction caused by an asteroid. And by the time the asteroid hit, most of the dinosaurs were already gone, if not completely gone already. And the reason they say that is because there's been what's called a gap below this KT boundary. It used to be about a 3-meter gap, which means 3 meters down, 3 meters below the KT boundary, researchers hadn't found any dinosaur bones. And 3 meters equates to about 100,000 years. So the skeptics would say, well, look, even 100,000 years before this asteroid hit, there were no dinosaurs. Now, that 3 meters has been shaved off gradually over the last few years. Paleontologists have made a few finds of, for example, some bones, and more recently, T-Rex footprints just 37 centimeters below the KT boundary. But that still leaves 37 centimeters and probably a few thousand, if not more than that, years where the dinosaurs could be completely gone. So this new study is all about trying to even narrow the gap even further.
And so how did they do that?
Well, similar to what had been done before, a team went out and they actually made a discovery at about 13 centimeters right below the KT boundary. So this is the shortest gap yet. And what they found was they found a horn from a type of dinosaur known as a ceratopsian. And if that doesn't sound familiar to you, Triceratops was one of this group of dinosaurs. And they did a bunch of dating, and they were able to confirm that indeed this horn that they found was only about 13 centimeters below the KT boundary. So added up with all the evidence, this 3-meter gap has really shrunk to about 13 centimeters, which is very, very little in just the past few years. And the team says that this is basically just stronger evidence, if any was needed, that the dinosaurs were doing fine up until the time that the asteroid hit.
But I'm guessing there are probably a few people out there who still aren't convinced.
That's right. You can't convince everybody. And indeed, one skeptic who we quote in the article says, look, yeah, you did find this horn, but the idea that you're just finding these sort of bits and pieces and just finding these very scant discoveries close to the KT boundary, where there's been a lot more discoveries much further down, supports the hypothesis that these dinosaurs were gradually dying out before the asteroid hit and there was fewer and fewer of them around. So it's not a study that's going to satisfy everybody, but for the authors at least, this is just one more piece of evidence that an asteroid did wipe out the dinosaurs.
And next, a clue to the fate of another doomed group, the Franklin Expedition.
Right. Well, this mystery is not nearly as old as the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. This mystery is only about 150 years old. It actually traces back to 1848, when a couple of ships, one ominously called the HMS Terror and another one called the HMS Erebus, became encased in ice in the Canadian Arctic. And what these ships were trying to do is they were trying to find the Northwest Passage, because people at the time had thought that there might be a sea route between the Northern Atlantic and the Northern Pacific. Turned out not to be the case, and these two ships really suffered the consequences. They became encased in ice for 20 months. And even though it seems like they had enough food to survive for a lot longer, at some point, the captain of the HMS Terror, known as Francis Crozier, decided that everybody needed to abandon the ships and start trekking across northern Canada in search of food. Well, unfortunately, nobody survived that journey. And then about 25 years later, an Inuit guide came across a shallow grave about 200 kilometers from where the ships were encased in ice that contained bones that researchers tied to one of the crew members. Now, at the time, one of the world's renowned biologists, Thomas Henry Huxley, identified the remains as Lieutenant Henry Levescant, who was supposedly a high-ranking officer as part of this expedition. This new study is about trying to figure out exactly who was this man really? Was it really Viscount? And what may have caused the demise of these men in the first place? Or why may they have abandoned their ships?
Okay, so they had this skeleton and they were trying to identify it. What did they look for?
Well, so what basically happened is the place that the skeleton is kept, which is a sort of a memorial to the Franklin expedition, this place was being renovated. And a new group of scientists came in and said, well, you know, while they're renovating this and they exhumed the skeleton, let's take another look and see if this really was Lieutenant Henry Levescant. And one of the interesting techniques they used was they actually tested the enamel of one of the man's teeth or one of the skeleton's teeth. And basically what they found is they can do this isotopic analysis, which really gives clues to the diet and the water supply of a region where somebody grew up. And when they were testing this, the enamel of the tooth, they deduced that this person probably came from northern Britain, not from Devon, as Levescant had. So that was the first clue that this may not be Levescant. And then they did some facial reconstruction, and they found that a lot of the facial features of this person seemed to match another of the expedition's members, a crew member known as Harry Goodsir. Now, that didn't really solve the mystery, but at least shed some light on who this person was that was found about 125 years ago. The next clue was trying to figure out exactly what killed this person. This person was actually the ship's doctor.
Well, you know, it's funny. I seem to remember reading something years ago about lead poisoning being a possible suspect.
And that still is. Another possible suspect that people had floated was scurvy. And the idea that was that these men were suffering from scurvy. They decided to get off the ship and maybe try to find some way to improve their situation. But the team that led this current research doesn't think that's likely, because they say these are really experienced sailors. They would have known about scurvy. They would have known about vitamin C. Also, when they were examining the bones, it's often if somebody has scurvy, they start to have a buildup of new bone on their bone surface that is tied to bleeding from scurvy. And they didn't see this on the remains of Goodsir. So they don't think it was scurvy. So getting back to your original point, Stuart, they are coming back possibly to this idea of lead poisoning, either by poor canning techniques that the sailors may have used, or that there was maybe lead from their seawater. They used this filtering apparatus to filter seawater. Perhaps lead contaminated the water that they were drinking, and that may have, you know, caused the slow decline of these men. Another theory that had been proposed was that these men had actually started starving to death and started eating each other. And the researchers did find gnaw marks on Goodsir's bones, but they deduced from their analysis that these were actually gnaw marks from an Arctic fox, not from human beings. So that seems to rule out the cannibalism hypothesis, at least for this one individual. So the mystery is not completely solved, but researchers have starting to get a much better idea of what may have gone wrong in this ill-fated expedition.
And finally, a tool-using fish.
Right, Stuart. This last story is about the first photographic evidence of what some scientists are saying is tool use in fish. So tool use used to be thought to be something that only humans could do. In fact, it was one of the classifications of our species. Only humans could use tools. Well, that has sort of fallen by the wayside over the last decade or so. Researchers have observed, for example, Capuchin monkeys that select a sort of hammer. They basically take rocks and they smash them against seeds to crack open the seeds. Also, even New Caledonian crows have been shown to probe branches with grass, twigs, and leaf strips to extract insects. And these are all sort of fit within the classical definition of what it means to use a tool. And some scientists have proposed that fish use tools too. There's a type of fish called an archer fish, which basically sprays a jet of water at prey on the surface and sort of knocks them into the water and then eats them. But that's kind of doesn't really fit with what a lot of people think about a tool is. It's sort of more of an interesting behavior, but not necessarily tool use. There's been some anecdotal reports that a fish called the black spot tusk fish uses tools, potentially by whacking prey, specifically clams, against a rock. But nobody had actually photographed this happening. And
so now this has been captured.
Now we've got the photographs. You can actually go to the site.
Got the pictures to prove it.
We've got the pictures to prove it. You can go to the site and check them out. And it's a really cool story. A diver named Scott Gardner was swimming around Australia's Great Barrier Reef when he heard this odd cracking sound. He said, "What's that?" And he swam over, and lo and behold, he saw this foot-long black tusk fish holding a clam in its mouth and whacking it against a rock. And the fish whacked the clam enough times that the shell soon gave way. Then the fish gobbled up the bivalve that was inside. Now, the diver thinks that he didn't just catch the fish just discovering how to do this, because all around the fish were all these broken clam shells indicating this fish or another fish had sort of been at this for a while. So it was a really cool, seems to be this very cool evidence that this fish is actually using a tool.
Well, it does bring up an interesting question, though, that you kind of alluded to, just what it means actually to use a tool.
It's a great question. And in fact, although these researchers say that this fish is indeed using a tool, it's using the rock as a tool. The rock is actually not something the fish is picking up. The rock is something that it's just banging this clam against. And one of the experts that was interviewed for the story said this isn't tool use. This is something that's called proto-tool use, because as she says, to really use a tool, the tool has to be something you pick up and carry around and smash against something else, just like the monkeys are doing with their hammer rocks or the crows are doing with their twigs. Here, the fish isn't picking up the tool. The fish is picking up the target of the tool. And some scientists would say that that is an evidence of tool use. So it's a bit of a debate right now. And I highly encourage our listeners out there to not only check out the pictures, but also check out the very interesting discussion that's going on in the comments section of this article. A lot of debate back and forth about whether this is a tool or not, and you can add your own thoughts to that as well.
Well, it sounds like a remarkable fish anyway.
Yes.
Okay, Dave, what else do you have in the works on the news site this week?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about supermassive black holes and what sparks them into existence. Also a story about a new HIV preventative that seems to be having a very powerful effect against AIDS in a couple of trials in Africa. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a new story about the Fukushima reactors in Japan, exactly what's going on with them at this date, a few months after the disaster in Japan. Also a story about the CIA and fake vaccinations, a very controversial topic. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, our chat this week is about green energy. Is it as promising as people think? What is the future of green energy in the United States and throughout the rest of the world? So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.